Shrink Wrap Radio number 320, Frontiers in Somatic Therapy, with Dr. Eleanor Criswell.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Eleanor Criswell, my longtime colleague in the psychology department at Sonoma State University, and we'll be discussing her long and pioneering history in the field of somatics. Eleanor Criswell, EDD, is Emeritus Professor of Psychology and former chair of the psychology department at Sonoma State University. Founding director of the Humanistic Psychology Institute, now Saybrook University in San Francisco, she is currently a distinguished consulting faculty member for Saybrook University, editor of Somatics Magazine, the magazine journal of the mind, body, arts, and sciences, and director of the Novato Institute for Somatic Research and Training. Her books include Biofeedback and Somatics Toward Personal Evolution, How Yoga Works, An Introduction to Somatic Yoga, and she is the editor of CRAM's Introduction to Surface Electromyography. She's president of the International Association of Yoga Therapists, the Somatic Society, and past president of Division 32, Humanistic Psychology of the American Psychological Association, the Association for Humanistic Psychology, and the Biofeedback Society of California. She's on the board of the Association for Hana Somatic Education, and she's the originator of Somatic Yoga and Equine Hana Somatics. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Eleanor Criswell, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you finally as a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. I should have had you on a lot sooner, and I apologize for not doing so. We've both been leading such busy lives, both before and after our, quote, so-called retirement.
Right.
And you've always been one of the international stars of our psychology department at Sonoma State University. I recall in years past that when I'd attend a conference or a meeting somewhere else in the country and mention that I was at Sonoma State University, they'd always say, oh, isn't that where Eleanor Criswell is? So I really should have gotten to you sooner.
Well, you and I retired from the university, but we have not retired from the world.
That's for sure. That's for sure. And I'm really impressed at the way that you're continuing to carry on. Among your many pioneering activities, you've had a long history and interest in working with the body. Do I recall correctly that in your youth, you were almost an Olympic swimmer?
Well, almost might be stretching it a bit. I did go to Purdue University to swim on their swimming team, sort of in preparation for moving toward the Olympics. Anyway, so I at that point, I discovered after years of marathon swimming, competitive swimming, and all that, I discovered the life of the mind. And that put an end to my...
Yeah, what a thought. And, and during the time that I've known you, you went on to do important work on the body, and some of the topics I want to touch on with you today in our conversation are yoga, biofeedback, Feldenkrais, Hana Somatics, the Novato Institute, and the Somatics Journal, and your work with horses. So we've got our work cut out for us here.
We do.
Okay, well, let's start with yoga. You taught a course on yoga and psychology way before the yoga craze got really big in this country. When did you first get exposed to yoga?
I really discovered it through meditation. Early 60s, like about 1961. And about 1966, I added in the physical practices. And And I did that by way of a book because there weren't any courses around where I was. And that was Fundamentals of Yoga by Ramurti Mishra, an Indian physician who was also a yogi.
Okay.
And so, go ahead.
Well, go ahead. You started to say something.
Well, just that I really like the effects of doing the asanas and all of that. And I might add in right now that currently I'm president of the International Association of Yoga Therapists.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like cream, you always rise to the top.
There's so.
Yeah, and there's always something new. So you actually taught an academic course at Sonoma State in yoga. I actually got to sit in, fill in for you, I think, for a few weeks one time. Tell us about how you structured your class.
Well, it was half lecture and half practice. And it went through the eight limbs of Raja Yoga, looking at the neurophysiology, the physiology, and the psychology, especially linking it up with things from Western psychology that, you know, had a relationship between the effects of yoga and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And I seem to recall that you were able to meet some of the really big names in yoga. BKS Iyengar?
I did not meet him. I until I was in India about a year ago, and we were both on the stage at the same time. I don't know if I've formally met him, but I've been close, shall we say.
Yeah, well, speaking of being on the stage, I know that back in the day, you were speaking at one or more major yoga conferences in India, and it sounds like you're continuing to do that.
Yeah, I am, and it's been very enlightening, shall we say. And one of the fascinating things for me, David, is that at the time that I was exploring yoga, some people were also exploring it freshly in India, and I had no connection with them, of course. But some of the things that were, for example, Dr. Nagendra, who is formerly with NASA, gave it all up to devote his life to yoga, is vice chancellor of SCIASI University near Bangalore or Bengaluru, was just going through that process of leaving NASA and devoting himself to yoga at the same time that I was exploring yoga and beginning our class at Sonoma State University. And so the parallels are interesting to me.
Are you saying that yoga was undergoing a revival in India at about the same time?
Yeah, and now it's gone through various revivals. Historically, for example, the Yoga Institute of Santa Cruz East, Mumbai, India, was founded in 1918, and it represents a renaissance of yoga, bringing yoga into modern times. And so there have been various, and we're going through one right now, the 20 million people, probably more now, practicing yoga in the United States. Similarly, it's growing an interest in India.
Wow, that's interesting because I think I assumed, and I would think most people would just assume that it's been kind of steady state in India. You know, that it's always been there, always going to be there.
Yeah, and that is true in a certain way, but not the whole population. Mm-hmm. Certain groups within India carrying on the lineages, and so forth.
This is a little bit of a digression, but maybe you've heard of, and I'm going to block on his name just momentarily, the laughing yogi in India.
Dev?
Pardon?
No, you're talking about the one who's doing laughing yoga.
Yes.
Yoga laughter.
Yeah, I got to interview him, and that was a lot of fun, too. And he was in, I think he was in Bangalore when we spoke. So, what do you see as the benefits of yoga?
My goodness.
I know, it's a big question.
And there's a lot of yoga research going on today. It's a very popular, federally funded yoga research out of NIH, NCAM, and others, and of course a lot of research going on in India, looking at the effects, which people have noticed over the years and have been aware of and have shared that with students coming along and so forth. But because it's working basically with the, we might say with the central nervous system, it affects everything. It affects us physically. It affects us psychologically. Of course, it affects us spiritually. It affects us on every level. But it's particularly good at helping us come back to homeostasis, to move out of sympathetic nervous system dominance, which has so many health impacts. And so it, because it's so systemic, if you will, it affects everything. So it has effects on sleeping and stress levels and mood has a huge effect on mood. And one of our people, Amy Weintraub, has done a lot of work with its effect on helping with people with depression. And, you know, so it has big physical effects and lots of psychological effects, self-esteem and you name it, it has an effect on it. And there are studies to support that and more coming.
Yeah, now, of course, it's being taught by so many people and in so many different ways. And I imagine that you've seen some of the recent press, not very long ago, I think there was a story in the New York Times about people getting injured. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah. A fellow wrote a book called The Science of Yoga, which sparked that article. And there are people who are injured doing yoga, especially if it's done incorrectly. But compared to all the other sports that people are doing, it's, you know, a whole different picture. A lot of the stuff in the book and also in the article are anecdotal.
Yes.
It's like one, I remember years ago there was a Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, front page, it said, "Meditation causes drop foot." And if you read the article closely, there was one guy who meditated too long sitting in the lotus position, and when he got up, he had drop foot. And what they didn't tell you was that in due time, he recovered. But here's this front page, international press, one guy who...
Yeah. Well, we always like the negative news, right?
Some good. Anyway, done correctly or done safely, and that's why I encourage people to do yoga somatically with a mind body awareness while they do it. Yoga has huge effects. It can reverse some of the effects of aging and.
Well, you've always been very youthful, both in looks and attitude. And aside from your teaching of it, what role would you say yoga has played in your life?
A huge role, because it has been a steady presence throughout. We're moving toward 50 years now. And I don't even know what my life would have been like without it, but it helped me go through a huge amount of stress in my life, and it's helped me probably avoid a few medical complaints that I might have had along the way, and certainly has kept me focused on my life's work, and whatever that is.
It's multifaceted, we can say that much about it.
It helps me stay happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, it now pops into my mind the name I blocked on. It was Dr. Madan Kataria, the laughing yogi. Yeah, so my apologies to him and my my growing blockage on names. Now, I recall that you and I both got interested in biofeedback around the same time, but you really took the ball and ran with it, creating a whole biofeedback course sequence at Sonoma State, building a biofeedback lab there, and eventually becoming president of the California Biofeedback Association. And who knows, maybe a president of something else now. What else can you tell us about your work in biofeedback?
Well, first of all, it has so informed me about how our physiology works in relationship to everything. It's like a window in to into the body, into the brain, into the mind, if you will. It's another thing. I don't know what I would do without it, because it so informs everything that I do. It's part of what helped change Thomas Hanna's work in functional integration, or Feldenkrais, into what it became, Hanna Somatics, or Hanna Somatic Education, which I helped train people.
Yeah, and we're going to talk later about that some more down the line here.
Yeah. Where I am with biofeedback now, and I'm still actively involved at the various levels, but I use it very much as a demonstration and as perhaps a single session with people, so that they can see what they're doing while they're doing whatever they're doing. You know, if they're changing, if they're meditating, or if they're practicing relaxing their bodies, or if they're trying to prepare for sleep, or various things that they may be working on. But one big place where I've been using it is when I teach a course at Meridian University in Petaluma for somatics for psychotherapists. We have a session in which the class gets to see what happens to the client physiologically, brainwave, muscle contractions, galvanic skin response or electrodermal activity, heart rate, hand temperature, all those things while they're in a psychotherapy session. Then they get to see, switch roles, now we see what's happening within the therapist while the therapist is engaged in psychotherapy. Yeah.
And the plot thickens.
The plot thickens, and it's very enlightening. Very enlightening.
That sounds fascinating and like a wonderful educational experience, kind of making the educational experience multidimensional. I recently I don't know if you know this fellow. I recently interviewed Dr. Paul Swingle, who is a psychologist who has a biofeedback clinic in Vancouver, and he's written a book titled Biofeedback for the Brain. And I was amazed at the specificity with which they are now able to map various areas of the brain for biofeedback purposes, and have they've even developed norms so that they can determine if something is off in terms of the expected brainwave frequencies and amplitudes for a given region. Is this something you've managed to keep up with in addition to all your other interests?
Vicariously.
Yeah.
What they frequently do is they'll do a quantitative EEG and map the brain.
Yes.
Look at areas that may be less active than others in relationship to the presenting complaint of the person, and then perhaps up-train that area or down-train that area. And they have a lot of specificity.
I was amazed at the specificity. At first, I thought this guy might just be a snake oil salesman with some of the claims that he was making. But then I realized, no, he had really worked to root his clinical practice in as much science as he could.
I think there's a long way to go on that research. You're seeing it where it is now, and I don't know whether there's the amount of research behind the specificity that we actually need.
Right. And yeah, one of the things he pointed out about that is so much of research is funded by big pharma, and this really runs counter to the interests of big pharma to have people, you know, heal themselves in some way other than through some kind of medication.
That's very true. And people also want quick fixes. And so there are some people who make good candidates for biofeedback or neurofeedback, and others who would never want to sit there for the training that it would take to make a difference, to self-regulate, to heal themselves.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that the field of biofeedback and neurofeedback is so incredibly valuable, and it is not known as much as it should be.
Right. That was my impression when I talked to him. I said, geez, why aren't people, you know, why don't we all know about this?
Well, the thing is, the media covers new news. They do not cover things that are continuing to be effective. They're accepted in all sorts of places where biofeedback would like to have been accepted. It is. But that's not big news to educate the public about its value and effectiveness and so forth. So that's one of the problems.
Yeah. Well, some of it was big news to me. He even cited a study asserting that it was possible to raise IQ by as much as 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
And he also said that on the basis of the brainwaves alone, he's able to tell people what problem has brought them to his clinic, you know, before he doesn't even let them tell their history until after he's done his measurements. You know.
Wow, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
But about the IQ thing, that is a very complex thing to try to measure. You would want to look at his research to see, how did they measure IQ?
Yeah.
IQ tests, as you know, are very faulty. And did IQ tests measure what IQ tests measure?
Right.
And
that's the definition, right? That's actually a fairly official definition.
Right. So what is, let's see his evidence. I like the idea. I love the idea because the degree to which you can pay attention to information coming in and respond to it quickly is part of IQ measures. And I think that one of the things that neurofeedback has shown is that training of attention through brainwave feedback is a doable thing. And many children with ADD and parents have reported changes that were quite beneficial.
Yes, he said that, in fact, ADD and ADHD were one of, I think, three major areas of dysfunction that biofeedback has been documented scientifically to be very effective for. Now, moving along, because we have all these topics, at some point you met and married Tom Hanna. I had been teaching a course of my own invention back in the early 70s called Psychology in the Body, because I had some intimation that there was something important here in the mind-body interface I couldn't fully articulate it, but I felt that there was something important here. And so I was using one of Tom's books, Bodies in Revolt, as one of the required books. So maybe you can briefly give us an overview of how you and Tom met and came to get married.
Well, I'll do this relatively quickly, but I want to say about Bodies in Revolt, I've reread it recently or been rereading it recently because people have been recommending it because it is so forward-looking. If you read it now, Thomas was very forward-thinking, but he also was prophetic in some of the things that he was pointing toward that would be happening and could be happening and so forth. So reading it now, it's kind of astonishing to consider that he wrote it on a little portable typewriter, a little Corona portable typewriter, way before computers and way before he had any experience with computers. And if you read it, you would not even know that. He's so projecting into where things are as they are.
Yeah, wow. You know, I haven't read it since way back in the day. But I remember how impressed I was at that time, you know, that it felt like, okay, this guy is really articulating the thing that sort of intuitively, no great specificity, I'm sort of feeling like, you know, is important. And here he is kind of really spelling it out.
And just as a side note here, you and I have paralleled each other in various ways.
I know we have.
With contact and also without contact. Just where our minds have gone and where our thoughts have gone and where So anyway, one of those aspects of the Bodies in Revolt, he talks about the proto-mutant and then the mutants. And this friend recently, who is very interested in Bodies in Revolt and who got me basically back into reading it again. I've been distributing it for all these years, but to read it again. And because he said to me, I'm a proto-mutant, he said. And he is a proto-mutant. And his sons are mutants, and the mutants are among us. And we are mutating rapidly with technological changes and other kinds of changes that are happening.
Yeah, people have used a similar expression for talking about the kids who are born into the computer thing. And I'm trying to remember what the expression is. It wasn't proto-mutant and mutant, but it was the same idea, and that will probably occur to me later as we go along. Mm-hmm. How did you and Tom meet?
Yeah. Yeah. I went back to complete my doctorate at the University of Florida, and I was also teaching at Jacksonville University at the same time, and I heard that this philosophy professor was interested in existentialism, which I was also. And so I wanted to sit in on his class, but I never could. So I actually met him at a Halloween party that Sidney Girard gave, a historical Halloween party at his house, and I met Thomas then. And from there, we started a dialogue about philosophy. He was very interested in the philosophy of the body. He was very much a phenomenologist. And so I was interested in what his ideas were, and I started bringing him psychological research and physiological, neurophysiological research, and that kind of confirmed what he was thinking about and exploring and so forth. So we developed a friendship.
So you actually started developing this friendship even before you started at Sonoma State.
Right.
Yeah, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, about 67, I think. And so our friendship continued over the years, and so I brought him out to be a visiting distinguished professor for the Humanistic Psychology Institute, which is now Saybrook Institute, and in about 72, and then we hired him in 73, and he moved out. So, and sometime later we married, about 74 we married.
All right. Now, eventually, you and Tom modified the Feldenkrais approach.
He organized the first professional training program for Moshe, especially in the United States, and trained with him and practiced functional integration. And as he practiced, his work began to evolve. And part of the evolution was bringing in the principles of biofeedback, which he learned in relationship to all of our discussions and his experiences and so forth. So in a way we did it, in a way he did it. In a way it's his work and his evolution, and with his death in 1990, I needed to carry it on for him. And so having been his right-hand person, it was possible for me to carry it on for him.
Well, as you know, I I've told you before how impressed I am with the way that you have carried it on and that you've attributed it to him and put his name on it. And I think that you're characteristically very modest and played a really large role in all of that. I even got to meet Feldenkrais at your house. You and Tom had him over for dinner, or had me over for dinner, and Feldenkrais was there, you know, and I was impressed by that. As I say, you always seem to rise to the top and meet the top folks. For people who are not familiar with Feldenkrais' work and subsequently Tom Hanna's somatic work, let's just dig in a little bit deeper and tell us about that.
Okay. So Feldenkrais was a genius, extraordinary human being, extraordinary.
From Israel, we should mention.
From Israel, and had his PhD in physics and was quite knowledgeable in physics. And I won't go into his whole history in France and England and back to Israel and so he developed a method, because he had a problem with a knee, for working with his own problem, and then he found it extremely beneficial for other people. And so it's a work, I'm going to contrast it with what Thomas later developed.
Good.
In Feldenkrais' work, in the hands-on work, the practitioner moves the client in all sorts of wonderful ways, especially approximating origin and insertion of muscles, which allows the muscles to relax. But that actually is a spinal cord event, we refer to it, and other things, triggering reflexes and all sorts of things to get the person to be able to move and maybe move in ways they haven't been able to move for a while or ever. It's extraordinary work. And so there are two parts of it. One is the hands-on work, and one is the floor exercises, which he called awareness through movement, or ATMs. And the purpose of those is to expand your movement repertoire, to help you differentiate parts of the body and, you know, just continue your motor development. And all, you know, thousands of wonderful exercises that he created and then people that he trained have created. And the Hanna somatic work is might think of it as the flip side of that. In Hanna somatics, the client does the moving. In the hands-on work, the practitioner asks the client to move in a certain way, and then provides resistance, something for the client to push against or pull against, to add a little extra load to the contraction, and then you slowly come out of the contraction. With that, you are changing levels of brain control from the brainstem motor tracts that are quite automatic up to the motor cortex, which is the only part of the brain that can actually relax the muscles. It's the only part of the motor system that synapses on little interneurons that can inhibit the firing of the neurons that are contracting the muscles. So it's sort of based on or relates to a natural process that all animals use, called pandiculation, named for that by various people in the animal sciences, such as Fraser, who was a Canadian scientist in the field of animal husbandry. And so other animals, you see a cat doing a arched back and an extended leg and a rounded back. You see horses also do it, dogs do it. Witness downward dog.
And the downward dog posture.
Downward dog from yoga. And what those actually are doing is contracting a group of muscles. It's not really a stretch. It's really contracting them and then slowly coming out of the contraction. And with that, they reset the resting level of their muscles, and they're ready to go. They do it after they eat, after they sleep, and anytime they feel some stiffness, they will do a pendiculation. And foals do it about 50 times a day, and as the horse gets older, they do it less and less frequently.
Okay, now my head is exploding with associations that I want to touch on here before they go away. One of the things that I'm struck with, both, I think, Feldenkrais and Hanna Somatics, as I understand them, is that it's about very slow, subtle movements. And in a way, it reminds me of the whole very large interest right now in mindfulness.
Yes.
And so the person, in both approaches, the person is being called upon to be mindful of very, very subtle movements. And this in turn puts me in mind of the practice of Tai Chi, which I did for several years, which was also almost painfully slow, very, very slow. And so even though, you know, there are these different forces coming from different directions, and also I recently interviewed somebody who's been working closely with Peter Levine, who's written about trauma, and that was based on study of animals shaking their bodies after they've experienced something traumatic. So there's that animal link again. So I have all these kind of corollary thoughts as I hear you speaking. And then I'm wondering about the relationship to bioenergetics. It feels like there might be some connection there too.
Well, the others are more associated. Bioenergetics, even though it's dealing with the body and dealing with the mind, is more likely to stir things up than it is to slow things down. So that's kind of where it departs from these other approaches. But I want to say the mindfulness thing, it's wonderful how much it is spread and how much it's used in hospitals and in communities and in schools and in classrooms and all of that. And there, all part of it also is a mindful yoga, which is a really wonderful addition to all of it, in which you're doing your yoga mindfully. The thing is that if you do things fast, the cerebellum does them, and it loves to do them, and it does them smoothly and does them well and does all that. But the cerebellum does not have any connection, direct connections with relaxing your muscles. It can run you around. It can do wonderful things, but it can't reset the muscles. So when you're moving slowly, the motor cortex is more likely to be in charge of the movements. So it's a different part of the brain.
And it probably has something to do with the plasticity of the brain.
Yes.
And a kind of relearning and modification of the brain, right?
Yeah, and it is wonderfully stimulating, and that contributes to the plasticity. It's a great use and involvement of the brain, because the cerebellum is unconscious. It's working at an unconscious level. If you're driving down the road and you realize you haven't been there, haven't been present for the last 30 miles, who's been driving the car? The cerebellum was driving the car.
Yeah.
But you weren't there. You were not conscious.
Yeah, sometimes we have that experience of feeling like we were in a trance or something, saying, oh, my God, where am I? What am I doing?
I know.
I'm lucky I didn't get into an accident. But it's because, as you say, the cerebellum was in charge and doing its job rather well.
And it's unconscious. So once upon a time in my life, I was interested in doing everything fast. I want to do things faster and faster. And I did. I did a whole lot of things very fast for many years. But the thing is, I was unconscious during a lot of it because the cerebellum was doing it. And so the thing is, when you go slowly, and many people resist going slowly, it's, you know, it's unfamiliar and it's uncomfortable. And
yeah, I find it hard personally.
Yeah. And so it's, but the thing is, if you do these kinds of things, some of the time slowly, this is what I tell my clients, you can do everything else that you do faster than ever before.
Uh-huh.
Because your muscles are not contracted and resisting your movements. So
now, see, that kind of touches on the thing that made me think about bioenergetics. And I know they, historically, they're not related. But the idea of character armor and chronic unconscious holding of muscles, it seems that's the part that seems to sort of be common.
Absolutely. And that's a part of Reich's work that is not necessarily a key part of contemporary bioenergetics. I don't know how much it is. I just don't know. But the thing is, it's a very valuable insight because one of the things that Thomas Hanna coined was something called sensory motor amnesia, in which you sort of forget how to move parts of your body or that you need to or how to control particular muscles, and they're sort of out of your control. They're being controlled for you. And so people wandering around, many of them are prisoners of their bodies. Their bodies are rigid, they can't move very well, and they're sort of stuck in them. Now, the good news is that can be changed. It can be changed almost instantaneously. But most people don't know it, so they wander around coping with not being able to move very well. And
That sounds like a strong claim that it can be removed almost instantaneously. Can you give me an example maybe from your own practice?
My own practice. Well, I...
Or somebody else's.
No. Yesterday? It was Sunday. I spoke at a Parkinson's support group in Napa, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And part of what I was sharing with them was that your muscles may become contracted, and when those levels are appropriate, you can decrease those that stiffness faster than if you waited for it to become more, the limb to become more flexible. So over and over again in my practice, I have people who come in and they're very contracted. You know, all the leg muscles are very contracted, and from whatever they've been doing, the stress of whatever they've been doing, and in the course of an hour, I mean, we can do it. It doesn't take an hour to do it because we're working with their whole bodies, but you can take a muscle, you ask the person to move and therefore contract, let's say, the bicep. So you bring your palm towards your shoulder, therefore flexing your elbow. You're contracting the bicep muscle. If you put your hand up and then press up against your hand towards your shoulder and then slowly allow your arm to straighten and repeat that a couple of times, your bicep muscle will not be sitting there contracted. It's that fast. You are inhibiting the firing of the motor units is what you're actually doing. But you can call it decreasing the output to the muscle. You are asking the voluntary motor cortex to stop firing the neurons that shorten the muscle fibers. And it's fast.
Okay. Now, you've created an institute in Novato, California, where you treat, train, and certify people in HANA somatic work.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that training program?
Okay. Well, it's basically over a three-year period. It's 2 9-day modules per year for 3 years.
Did you say 2 or 3 years?
2. It's 3 years. 3 years, and in those 3 years, there are 2 9-day modules per year.
Okay.
So that every 6 months, they come for 9 days. And they learn how to do the hands-on Hanasomatic education work and also how to teach the somatic exercises, which are briefer than the awareness through movement exercises because the purposes are different. The awareness through movement exercises from Feldenkrais, you might do 45 minutes a particular movement sequence, and you're working with half of the body. In the daily maintenance exercises with the Hanasomatic system, and I'll get back to the training in just a second, you can do them all within about 10 minutes once you know the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And you can maintain your physical comfort and flexibility and so forth on an ongoing basis. But anyway, the training, following the first module, you are ready to work with many people who you would have a chance to work with. And the people who come for the training, some are massage therapists, some are physical therapists, some are psychologists, some are computer scientists, some are, you know, the whole range
yeah.
of fitness instructors and all sorts of, sometimes Pilates instructors and all sorts of people who have a body-mind interest.
Yeah. So, now, you also publish a journal called Somatics.
Mm-hmm.
And am I right that you're also the founder as well as the editor of that journal?
You might call me a co-founder.
Okay.
I consider Thomas as the founder.
Uh-huh.
His idea, and I served as the associate editor or whatever for the years while he was living. And I took it on in 1990 and have published it ever since. So I'm the editor and the publisher of Somatics Magazine.
Okay, and we have been throwing the word somatics around as if everybody in the audience knew what we were talking about. So how do you define somatics, and what sorts of articles would appear in Somatics Magazine?
Okay, so somatics is a term coined by Thomas Hanna. It comes from the Greek word soma, which referred to the living body versus the corpse. And so he took the adjective, which is somatic, which in English is used to refer to things having to do with the body, period, and added an S, which makes it a noun, and used it as the label for the mind-body disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many of them. You've mentioned some of them already, Tai Chi and Feldenkrais and yoga and biofeedback. And there are a number of mind-body disciplines going about the bringing integration of mind and body in different ways. And so the magazine publishes articles from all those different traditions. Plus it has a section in there dealing with research that is relevant to the somatic disciplines coming from PubMed and PsycINFO and all wherever else about study, all kinds of studies from different research approaches that shine light on the somatic disciplines. So somatics is a term for the mind-body disciplines.
So what do you think, then, about the notion of somatic work as a psychotherapeutic approach?
I think it's excellent. Because... Go ahead.
Because...
Okay. Because here we have a client sitting there, maybe for years, talking about dreams and life and issues and feelings and all those things, but talking, by and large. When you bring in the body into the equation, then the person can express everything more, can make the changes more readily, and so forth and so on. It revitalizes the whole process. Plus, for the psychotherapist, there's a wonderful book by Babette Rothschild on Help for the Helper. The psychotherapist is sitting there for years listening to people's problems and so forth and getting sometimes tenser and tighter over the years. And so for the therapist to remain somatically comfortable and the client to move on developmentally, both mind and body, is very beneficial. So for years I have been trying to bring that into APA in various ways. We all make our little contributions. And it's coming in more and more. And the thing is that what I have said is, okay, you're talking about behavior. We have the year of behavior, the national year of behavior. Well, what is doing the behaving? The body is behaving. Why are you leaving it out? How can you leave it out?
Yeah.
So bringing it in brings in all sorts of other things to be concerned about, but it also brings in a very motivating, vitalizing aspect to the psychotherapeutic process.
Right. That makes sense to me. Now, one of the things that I found particularly fascinating is that in recent years you've extended that work, the I guess it's the Hanna somatic work, to working on horses. Mm-hmm. How did that come about, and with what source of results?
Okay, well, I was doing some somatics classes and some somatic yoga classes for a equine clinician in Pen Grove, whose name is Dennis Reese. And at a certain point, he asked me, do you think it could be done with horses? And so I said, probably. And I went home and I thought about it and I read and I searched and I so forth and so on. And it came to me how to do it with horses. And so I went back up to his ranch and we tried it with one of the horses and the horse responded immediately. And so from
the horse, was the horse sort of moaning, oh boy, that feels so good.
Kinda. There are other ways. This was a gelding. There are other ways this horse showed its relaxation, but it relaxed immediately.
Uh-huh.
And the horse's name is Tristan, owned by Shirley Park, and he's the historical horse. Since then, we have done it. I have a training program. I teach people how to do it. I have a DVD so people can do it themselves out there. It follows the same principles. It's an adaptation of Hanna somatics to horses and also occasionally to dogs. It asks the horse to move and therefore contract a group of muscles. You are working, in this case, with gravity, and then you ask the horse to slowly come out of the contraction about three times, and the horse will have relaxed all the muscles that were used in lifting that limb. And we're asking the horse to use its frontal lobe, just like we're doing with humans, as compared to the cerebellum and brainstem and so forth. And in about an hour, you can go through all the major muscles. And the horse stands better, has a better, you might say, posture slash conformation, and moves more easily, is happier, just like a human being. And
well, maybe at some point you'll get a chance to test these ideas out with a Kentucky Derby horse.
I would love.
Have you
love
ever thought about that?
Oh, I have. And two people that I've trained have worked with racehorses, one in England and one in Ireland. And in fact, the one that was worked with in Ireland came over the horse. One of the horses, and one of the Breeders' Cup, a particular part, you know, particular race in the Breeders' Cup series. So it has big potential for racehorses. I would love to have a chance to introduce that to people who are working with racehorses.
Yeah.
So this work is useful all the way from a backyard beloved horse, all the way, including horses that have some lameness issues that have to do with chronically contracted muscles, to high-performance horses. So I worked with one horse that was in a show and had been jumping and sort of hurt his back, and I happened to be there, so the trainer asked me to help help the horse, which I did, and the next day he won his event and was able to perform the next day and won his event. And so it's the whole gamut there.
Yes, yes. Well, I would say so. Well, on a totally different topic now, do I recall that you had something to do with the publication of The Course in Miracles? Because the impact of that course has come up in several of the interviews I've conducted, and I seem to recall that you played a pivotal role.
I did, and I, in an odd way, I still do.
How's
I did.
That?
Well, I Judy Scotch was her name at the time, came to me when I was with the Humanistic Psychology Institute, told me she wanted to work, use the course as part of her doctoral work. And so seeing the course, hearing about it, I offered to publish it for her through my little press called Free Person Press. On the way toward it finding a larger publisher. So this is, I think of it as kind of an interim publishing. And so I did publish it in a, you know, just a few, whatever, 500 copies or whatever it was. And from there, then she got funding for a hardcover edition, and it went on and went all over the world.
Yes.
And at the time, when the last time I took it for duplication, I had a little sad feeling. At that point, I didn't know I would no longer be involved with it. But part of me must have known. And I realized that I could not go with the course. The course had to go off without me. And because I had other things I had to do.
I would say so.
Yeah.
So many.
So, but the thing is, though, many years later, a group who loved The Course in Miracles wanted to break the copyright. They wanted to make it available on the internet and et cetera, et cetera. So they took it to court. It was, a suit went on for quite some time. They won. It's a whole complex story for part of the publication of the course. They won for an edition prior to it being reworked a little bit and so forth. So there is something called the Criswell edition.
Oh, my goodness.
And you can get it on the internet.
Oh, my goodness.
And download it.
Wow.
I tried really hard. You know, they interviewed, it was interesting, I was deposed during that trial, and so I made my contribution there. I, you know, told them that I'm very much protective of copyrights and my feelings about it and so forth, which wasn't relevant to the case. But it was like the other shoe dropping. Here's the first publication. Here's being deposed in court. In fact, you can get you can download the deposition.
I think people may download the Criswell edition. I don't know if they'll want to download the deposition.
I don't think it's necessary. I think parts of it. Anyway, it is of interest because Helen Futchman, wonderful, bright woman who, so to speak, channeled it, was a professor at Columbia University at the time she was transcribing this, and she was also on the editorial board for the Journal of Abnormal Psychology.
Amazing.
And she was very much disowning this. You know, yes, I'm doing it. I'm writing these things down, and we're transcribing it and doing this for about 6 years. But I'm not the author of it. So she did not claim authorship. And so it's a complex case here.
Yeah, I'll say so. Well, we've just scratched the surface of your wonderful and complex and multifaceted life. I wonder if there are any final points you'd wish to make as we wind down here.
Okay, just one point, and that is that everything that I have done, I've done because I felt inspired to do it. But it all comes together in wanting to contribute to the development of human beings within the global context. They're all approaches toward fostering development.
Well, yeah, that really does tie them together. Well, mm-hmm. Dr. Eleanor Criswell, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been great fun dialoguing with you, David. It's a wonderful program, and I look forward to continued discussions.
I hope you found my colleague Eleanor to be both inspired and inspiring. I certainly do. She's also quite wise. At one point, she was the chair of the psychology department, and about a year before her term was over, she began to cultivate me as the next chair. Previous chairs before her had complained about how burdensome and awful it was to be chair. In her own quiet way, Eleanor made it look like she wasn't doing anything, made it look effortless. Nevertheless, I was terrified of the job. I had seen that it had broken others, and I was afraid it might break me. I thought it was too big for me, too adult. I had spent many years keeping below the university-wide radar and staying ignorant of how university organization works, budgets, and so on. The department had selected me to be the next chair, and I was in a bit of a panic about it. Eleanor suggested that we start getting together for lunch on campus. Without really spending a lot of our focus on the mechanics of the department, she would periodically remind me over these lunches that I was the best qualified for the job, and that I was more than up to it, and that I should realize what an honor it would be to head up this very special department that was fairly unique in academia, with a worldwide reputation in such things as humanistic, existential, and transpersonal psychology. Somehow her subtle magic worked on me, and I became less and less fearful about the prospect. I also did a 180-degree turnaround in my attitude, vowing to myself that I would consider myself successful only if I didn't want to give the job up at the end of my 3-year term. As a result, I ended up serving as chair for 7 years and would have served longer had not another colleague lobbied hard for it at that point. That experience of learning to love that which I had feared so much turned out to be one of the peak learning experiences of my life. So thank you, magical Dr. Eleanor Criswell. Hello, everyone. Did you miss me? Sorry this episode is so late, but I have been swamped ever since my return from Sweden. We had a wonderful weekend dream workshop, and I wish you all could have been there. But then, I don't think the room would have been large enough. I want to shout out big thanks to Oscar and Irina, who helped set up the workshop on the Swedish end, and also to Irina and Simon for taking care of my accommodations very wonderfully. Greetings and appreciations to all the workshop attendees and Shrink Wrap Radio friends that I got together with on the trip. It was so wonderful to spend time with you all, Simon and Stina, Michelle and Stefan, Oscar, Irina, Anders, Elham, and Samanda. The weather in Uppsala and Stockholm was perfect, very autumnal. I'd love to fill you in on all the tourist details of my first trip to Sweden, but I'll limit myself to one of the coolest things. I'm not sure if I've let this out before, but I'm a big fan of crime fiction, and most recently of the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series. I've read all 3 books and saw all 3 of the Swedish films, plus the first of the David Fincher American films. Those of you who are also fans will remember that the story revolves around journalist Mikael Blomqvist. Well, it just so happens that my Stockholm host, Simon, has a brother who lives in that very apartment that they used in the film. The brother was away that day that Simon gave me a tour of the apartment, and we were able to take some iPhone snapshots of me there. Now I have to watch the girl with the dragon tattoo film again, hopefully with someone else, so I can say, I was there! I was there! They do have girl with the dragon tattoo tours in Stockholm, but this was an insider experience that other tourists don't get to experience. Simon, my new friend, thanks for this and all the other highlights of Stockholm that you shared with me. I'm hoping that this dream workshop in Sweden will inspire those of you in other places to host a workshop. My bags are packed and ready to go to Australia, New Zealand, the UK, or wherever. By the way, I am leaving on another trip, this time to Montreal, to be a presenter at a market research conference. I'll be gone from October 1st through October 11th, and it'll probably take me time to recover from that trip as well. So there will be another hiatus in Shrink Wrap Radio episodes. Speaking of episodes, we have a boatload of new transcripts. The first is thanks to Jeremy Devins, who has transcribed Shrink Wrap Radio number 260, Whole Psychiatry with Robert Hedaya, MD. Then we have six new transcripts, all from Dale Hoff. Thank you, Dale. And he has he's gone way back and transcribed Shrink Wrap Radio number 14, High School Psychology and Podcasting, Shrink Wrap Radio number 16, Psychology in Australia, Shrink Wrap Radio number 18, Two Blokes in an Aussie Pub Discuss Psychology, number 22, Snake Dreams with Robin and Suzanne Maiden, number 184, Working with Families and the Courts with my colleague Dana Schneider, and finally, number 190, Iconocards, the Untaro, with my market research colleague, Dr. Sharon Livingston. I'm not sure if I've had a chance to announce yet the latest continuing education course in my Mind, Body, Spirit series. This one is called Meditation and Psychotherapy, and it is for 8 units. You'll find a link to it under the Store tab on our Shrink Wrap Radio site. Finally, don't forget to help support Shrink Wrap Radio if you're not already doing so. Just go to the site and click on that big green donate button and choose the level of support that works for you. And thanks.
Hi, I am Oscar.
Hi, I'm Michelle.
Och du lyssnar på Shrink Wrap Radio.
So with that final little sound clip from Oscar and Michelle in Sweden, I think I'll wrap it up here, both to keep the show from getting too long and also to get it out to you that much sooner.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink Wrap Radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.